Welcome to Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber. This is a cricket podcast where we answer the questions from the group. If you're on YouTube, the best way of doing that, of course, is sending through a super chat, but you can send through normal questions as well. But if you can't get to the live YouTubes, the best way of the YouTubes? We'll go with that for now. If you can't get to those, the best way of doing it is to go to patreon.com/Jared Kimber. And you can sign up as first class member or above, and you can ask questions once a week. Like, you would have thought I'd have that question ready quicker. Jessica says, and Jessica's also in the comments. Jessica's everywhere, right? Jessica says, can you please tell us your opinions about Everybody Loves Raymond as being a mainstream representation of a popular and successful sports journalist? I mean, the biggest issue, and this is pretty much every sitcom character ever, right, is outside of maybe The Office characters, is that they don't actually, he never seems to be doing any work. He doesn't seem to take that many phone calls would be my other thing, which is if you're a beat writer, you are making and receiving phone calls all the time. So I'm going to assume he's a beat writer from what we could see in the show that, you know, he follows the team around and reports on them directly. Where's all the phone calls? Is the manager in? Is the manager out? Are they signing a star player? Is someone getting, traded? Like, what's happening? There's no phone calls. There's no energy, right? You sit next to Nick Holt or George Dobell, you know, these great, you know, beat writers. Chris Barrett used to be one in Australia. It's just frenetic, right? Their phones are going, they're sending messages all the time. They're getting information. They're trying to stand that information up. They're trying to learn things. Ray doesn't do any of that, right? So he's either a terrible beat writer or what I would call a stenographer who basically just goes there and writes out what has happened in the game and then goes back. Or he's not a beat writer and he's a feature writer. And if so, we don't see him write all that much. Yeah, I just don't think Everybody Loves Ray. It's a real shame because obviously I would say he picked that because he thought it was a cool job and it's not. It's not very accurate. And there also aren't a lot of scenes of him doing his job. And when they are, I can't remember what seasons they're in, maybe in some of the later seasons. Again, it feels like they're missing a moment of some of the hilarity that goes on, within that. You know, there's another sitcom now about, I forget what it is, but it's Hank Azaria, isn't it, where he's a commentator. That's probably far more accurate if you're looking for a representation of the sports media in sitcoms. I would say the Hank Azaria one, for all the nonsense around it, is probably a lot more similar. And one of the things I like about the Hank Azaria one is he's essentially a person he has a great voice, right? And that's why he becomes a commentator. And I've said this before, that happens so often and people sort of ignore that. I know there was a guy in Australia who I remember from years ago who like didn't particularly say anything that interesting, but God, he had a great voice. You could understand why people wanted to put him on, on broadcast. Patrick says, all these questions about baseball. In baseball, a fielder's quality is almost entirely based on their range, i.e. how much ground they can cover. How true should this be for cricket? Well, I think cricket's very different anyway, because there are multiple different positions. So an outfielder in baseball is an outfielder, right? And I know there are three different versions of that, but generally you're going to be in the same position over and over again. That's very rare in cricket, right? If you have your best outfielder in a T20 game, they're probably going to field depending on where you think the ball is most likely to be hit. So fielding a deep backward square leg is very different than fielding it long on or long off, right? But they both might be very important. You know, quite often you'll see a really good fielder at deep point for a leg spinner to try and cut off the sort of the sliced cut shots from going for boundaries and things like that, right? So you stack your field in different ways. So you need more variation in your fielding to begin with. So it isn't just about how much distance you can cover like a baseball fielder. Also, most baseball fielders pick the ball up quite regularly because they have a glove. So we have, you know, human hands catching our balls. So the ability of your hand, so someone like Mark Waugh, he may not cover ground as quickly as Martin Guptill, might actually be more useful because of his instincts, his ability to cut angles off quicker, and then also the fact that the ball's always going to go into the middle of his hands. So I think there's a few, and then And then also with baseball, most of them are pretty good throwers. You know, that's a bit more variable in cricket, right? Not everyone has that sort of big arm. It's not throwing arms aren't as, and this is probably a flaw within cricket, but throwing arms aren't as coveted or pushed in cricket outfielders. And then the other thing you would have, Patrick, is simply catches, right? Catches are very, very different. So I think there's a few different things. But yeah, there's no doubt Coram Pollard and Ben Stokes are two guys, if you watch in the outfield, their ability to cut angles off at pace and cover, you know, large periods of large parts of the ground is huge. And when you talk about range, Patrick, one of the other interesting things about that is slip fielders. So the best slip fielders can cover more distance, and the best wicketkeepers as well can cover, can stretch themselves out a little bit more. Ram Kumar says, Dravid has an interesting legacy as captain and coach. He won his first ever test in South Africa, beat England in England, won 16 consecutive chases in ODIs. However, meekly surrendering the test series after being one up in South Africa in 06. Oh my God, there's a lot of details here. Yeah, okay. Has he not been able to shake his defensive mindset as a person overall? Too many incidences to call it bad variants. I mean, it's funny you say that. I'm not sure I would call Rahul Dravid a defensive person. I think he's a defensive-led batter. You know, when I chatted to him about batting recently, he talked a lot about trying to sort of copy someone like Ricky Ponting and realizing he didn't have the tools available to him. Like his main tools were technique, you know, guiding the ball to backward point, and hitting the spinners far out and back in the crease and these sorts of things. And when he tried to turn himself into a, you know, more of a player like Ricky Ponting, he couldn't work out what to copy. So I don't think of him as a defensive player. I just think that the skills he had, it's the same way with Kane Williamson. I don't think of either of them as defensive players. That's their main skill set, is hitting the ball under their eyes. Whereas KP couldn't do that. KP had to be out and in front in the way that he played. So that, of course, is going to look, what is going to be more aggressive because you're meeting the ball rather than waiting for it to come to you. So I'm not sure if I 100% agree with that. The captaincy thing is so long ago. I mean, you know, I would have to go back and have a look at it and you know, have a really good thought process on it. They lost the 2023 final. They lost the semi-final in 2021. I don't think it was just him. From the outside, and I do know some other people on the inside over there as well, I do feel like they have tried to come up with a more relaxed environment for the Indian cricketers. I do think they have been more aggressive under Rahul Dravid than they were under previous captains as well in Test cricket and under previous coaches. So yeah, I don't quite follow what you're saying there, Ryan. Or don't agree. I follow it. Ian says, Umar Gul was a tremendous T20 bowler and twice a top wicket taker in the early World Cups. If he was 10 years younger and still playing now, would his bowling stand up as it was, or would he need to add to his T20 game? It's a good question. I mean, he was a Yorker bowler probably at a time when you could still get away with being a Yorker bowler. But part of the reason he was such a good Yorker bowler was his ability to reverse it. He was actually a very good bowler of the bouncer. And I don't... cats have pulled something down downstairs. And I don't remember him bowling the bouncer all that much in T20 cricket at that stage. It was funny. I did a show with Steve Harmison the other day where he said he kept getting hit in the head by Umar Gul. So I think if that was the case, Umar Gul would be a more interesting bowler now just because he would do more things. His accuracy on the Yorker, I don't remember him being a specialist of wide Yorkers, so he'd do that. So I do think he would have other things that he could use that he probably didn't need as much back then. You know, it's the Joel Garner thing, right? Joel Garner would be a very different bowler if he bowled today in T20 cricket. He couldn't just come in and bowl at the stumps over and over again, right? The way he did, you know, you watch some of the good spells that we have of him in one day cricket. It's like, Joel Garner's just, you know, early on he's bowling back of a length outside off stump, and then later on he's just bowling at the stumps. He could do that because at that stage, that's how players were playing. But you think about it, Joel Garner's, 6'6", 6'7", certainly very fast, certainly very accurate, and was a great bowler of a Yorker, also would now be able to bowl wider Yorkers. His bouncer and his short balls would be more important. He would probably bowl more back of a length at the body at times if he came back. So both of those bowlers have other skills that they probably didn't need at that stage that would be quite handy if they came back, if they were, you know, playing in modern cricket. The other thing is that you develop in the period that you bowl, right? So you are, whether you do this consciously or unconsciously, the era that you play in and the way that batters bat against you and the way that the pitches are and the format that you play in dictates how you develop. So both of those players, you know, just pick two random ones, would be better pot bowlers now because they would have worked out how to make that work for them. Ubik says, what's your predicted score line for the upcoming Border Gavaskar series? 3-3. I think I did 3-2 to Australia when we were doing the World Test Championships predictors. I think we did that, didn't we? Did I do that in a dream? I've got a feeling that we did that. I went through on the... someone made a predictor online and we went through and had a look at all that and did that. So I think I had Australia at 3-2. I don't often pick draws, but I suppose draws are also possible. Bumrah is a big one. You know, Siraj has been so interesting over the last couple of years. Mohammad Shami's fitness, all these things are quite important. They probably want Hardik to play, wouldn't they, as well? Hardik at 6 and Jadeja at 7, or Hardik at 7 and Jadeja at 8, gives them some flexibility, I would have thought. So, you know, fitness and availability is going to play a big part from that. Can't wait to see Jaiswal. We know he didn't make any runs in South Africa, although, to be fair, no one made any runs in South Africa. Interested to see how they go and everything. But I would still think that Australia is slightly better. But I don't know what Australia's batting lineup quite is at the moment because of the whole Steve Smith thing, Cameron Green at 4, you know, there's a few moving parts, you know, the attacking players later on, everything else. So yeah, it's 3-2 seems a simple one. When I went through it, and I probably spent about 15 minutes having a look at it before I came up with those off the top of my head. So yeah, I don't do a lot of series predictions. And the reason is that, especially in Test cricket, I probably do less serious predictions in Test cricket than almost anything else. And the reason is quite simple, that the pitches dictate how things are going, and then injuries and form and matchups play such a big part over the course of it. I just don't see what it adds, right? If I'm going to do analysis, I want to do analysis on cricket that has been played rather than on cricket that is going to be played. That's generally how I look at those sorts of things. So, you know, partway through a series, I'm probably... You know, if it's a 5-test series, by the second test, I've got a million different theories of different things that can happen and how things can go ahead. I only give predictions really when people ask. And even then, I don't like, if you're asking for a prediction, the best way to put it is I'm probably going to give you a crap one. Ubik says, what are the best test batting and test bowling efforts in a losing cause? Does Ajaz Patel count as one of those with his 10 wicket haul? I was looking this up recently and I'm trying to think of the game. Oh, Virat Kohli's 200s in Adelaide is one that I certainly remember as just a brilliant one. Did Border make 200s against the West Indies in a losing test in the West Indies? Or was it, was 100 and one was not 100 maybe? Is another one that comes to mind. Bowling. It's harder with bowling because quite often if you bowl really well, I remember this, just a random one. I remember Ryan Harris bowling incredibly well at Durham and forcing Australia back into a test match there that I think they ultimately still, well, they certainly still lost. Trying to think of some other great ones. Yeah, nothing else massively comes to mind, Ubik, for bowling. I mean, I'm sure there are others that I'm, you know, not thinking about. You'd be looking at, I mean... I suppose the best way to do it would be to go to bowling. I'm just going to see if, how easy it is on Stats Guru to come up with that. Because you would go with losing the game, lost the match, and then you want match by match innings. And if you look at that by wicket, yeah, so Ajaz Patel. Oh, Kapil Dev's. Took a 9 for Didney in a loss. So there's another one. There's a lot here that I'm not aware of. But those are, they look like a, spinners taking a lot of wickets, going for a lot of runs. Bishu took 8 for 49 in a losing test. In fact, and Lyons one comes up too, 8 for 50. Mitchell Johnson at Perth is a really good one. 8 for 61 in Perth when he was bowling big, these big fast cutters. And I think, did he send Callis to hospital? Bricky's hit his hand or something? Was certainly another one that comes to mind. I'm just trying to go through a few of these, see if there's any others that are. I can see here that Hugh Tayfield took 7 for 23 at Durban and lost the test. You've got to feel unfortunate from that. And Mike Casper at 7 for 36 at the Oval in 97. I'd forgotten about that one. And let's see if we can do the same for batting. See if there's any other great innings or that we've got. Ponting made 242 at versus India in Adelaide. And there's another one here. Brian Lara made 226. Nathan Astle lost that test. He made 222 off 168 balls. There's a couple of really good Lara ones in here as well. Another one in Colombo where he made a double 100. We've got a double 100 of Shakib Al Hasan against New Zealand in Wellington. There's another Ponting one I was just thinking about is the 2009 Oval. I thought he just batted incredible in that game. Oh, one of my favourites. This one I should have remembered. Aubrey Faulkner, 204 at Melbourne. Went out, smashed 204. I think it was the first time a South African had scored a double 100. I think it was the first time South Africa had scored over 500 in a test match. Victor Trumper went out and on his own, basically erased that. And then South Africa went back out to bat and bowled out for 80. Tragic. Aubrey Faulkner completely set that game up for them. The batting in the second innings was abysmal from South Africa and never got there. Let's take a quick break here on a Wagon Wheel and we'll be back with more questions like that one.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are analysing every part of our game. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is really happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket8.com is your place for cricket intelligence.
All right, Ram Kumar says, what will be Dravid's legacy? Well, probably one of the greatest players of spin of all time is probably where it starts, right? The Scottie Pippen to Sachin Tendulkar's Michael Jordan is probably the other one. I mean, as a coach, and I'm assuming you partly mean this as a coach, his legacy will last if they continue to play really, really attacking cricket over the next couple of years, because I do think that they certainly upped their attacking nature under his reign. I think I would be right in saying that in run rates across the board, but I'd have to go back and check. So I do think that was something a little bit different, but I'm not sure he has a huge lasting legacy as a coach. If they win this World Cup, it'll be that, right? Adityan says, we have off-spinners, Maxwell, Riyan Parag, Jadhav, and even Ashwin to play. Bowl round arm as a variation. And we have a leg spinner bowl round. Have we had a leg spinner bowl a round arm before? Or do you think it is just physically impossible to put wrist spin on the ball with a horizontal arm? Similarly, will we see pacers bowl with an occasional round arm? Yeah, I think we have seen some pacers do it before. And the story I know is Cameron Gannon, the Australian bowler who ended up playing for the USA, I think, didn't he? I know he worked on it, but I have seen some bowlers do that. You do see bowlers drop their arm further in the death sometimes. They don't necessarily bowl round arm, but I'm sure that there are some bowlers who at the death, if they go from, you know, quite vertical, they come around a little bit lower, especially when you're looking for reverse swing sometimes. The problem with round arm wrist spin is that it's hard to put the side spin on the ball. So if you're bowling a round arm wrist spin, it's probably going to come out more as top spin, which, you know, is handy, but wrist spinners, even when they bowl normally, are still putting top spin on the ball. So I can't see a reason why a wrist spinner would be successful doing that, unless they're a wrist spinner with a different kind of variation or a slightly different version of wrist spin. So I don't see any reason to do that. Whereas off spinners have always done this. We see it more in T20 cricket now, but finger spinners and off spinners, quite often will do that, especially, you know, you go to a lot of part-timers throughout the years would often drop their arms and try and skid the ball through. It was a very popular tactic, what, between overs 30 and 35 probably in ODI cricket. It's one of these things that people forget of like, oh, the, you know, two new balls in ODI cricket is such a big advantage for pace bowlers. And I'm like, well, that's not actually true because spin is really like a hard ball that bounces and spins as well. But what it's a big disadvantage for is the sort of Darren Lehman bowlers who would just try and skid the ball in, who are utterly terrible and no one ever wanted to really watch them bowl all that much anyway. That's the bowler that really got ruined from that. So if you go back, there's a lot of sort of finger spinners who would quite often do that on certain kinds of wickets. Sanjay Jayasuriya could sometimes do it as well. Certainly a lot better bowler than someone like Lehman. Most likely team to get upset in the Super 8s by the US. I think we covered this on the podcast I did the other night. So it's England, South Africa, West Indies. England, South Africa, West Indies, yeah, and USA. In that group. So I think I gave USA about a 5% chance of beating Pakistan. I don't know if I would give them a 5% chance of beating any of these other sides. We have to have a look at the wickets there, don't we? Because I think that's the best way of answering that. Because there are certain kinds of wickets in this tournament. So South Africa's playing USA at North Sound. That should be a bit of a shootout. I could see a situation where South Africa don't put their foot down enough there and get themselves into a little bit of trouble. And if the USA is used to anything of recent times, it's close games. So I think that's certainly one that we could see. Then where are they playing the West Indies? Playing the West Indies at Barbados. Well, that's a low-scoring ground. I think Akhil Hasan and Moti are going to be a big issue for the USA there. But a lot of those low-scoring games in this tournament so far have been closer than we would think, you know, just because of how things go there. And then where is their last game? Last game against England is against Barbados. I think England's the least likely. Just because I think that they will, I just don't think the USA has bowling options that's going to slow them down or dismiss them. I would probably rank, if South Africa were playing in Bridgetown, I would have them as number one. But because the West Indies are playing them at Bridgetown, I probably have them slightly higher. But again, I don't think I have any team higher than a 10% chance of losing any of those games off the top of my head without going through the full details. I think that's probably fair. Vivek says, which South American team is most likely to participate in the men's T20 World Cup in the next decade? I'm glad you said men's, because otherwise it would be the Brazilian women's team, wouldn't it? I don't follow South American cricket all that closely, but I can give you two potential answers. Argentina or Guyana. It's probably unlikely to be either of those, but I think those two teams are, you know, if the West Indies do crumble, then you would have, then Guyana has a chance of qualifying. But I don't know enough about South American cricket. Weirdly enough, because of the Brazilian women's team and the stuff that's been going over there at the moment, I've paid a little bit more attention to the women's, but the men's, I don't know as much about. But my guess would be Argentina just because they have the best infrastructure. But I don't know I remember someone telling me that they were starting to get their act together a little bit, but I haven't looked into that myself. James says, has anyone tried to make an NBA Jam style cricket game with things like power-ups, players heating up and then pulling off ludicrous plays, etc.? Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I think the thing with, NBA Jam is such a particular thing. It's an arcade game, isn't it? So I don't think there's been that many big versions of cricket arcade games. Cricket games really got big on PC, didn't they? I think as much as anything. That's my memory of it. Anyway, PC and then what? PlayStation, I suppose. Were they the sort of the two that cricket sort of came through? an arcade is a very, very different thing. I don't think the people who created NBA Jam thought that. And is that it's not like there are other versions of NBA Jam. Like FIFA is probably now a much bigger game than NBA Jam, right? But FIFA, there's so many big like arcade versions of football games, like from the really basic ones to really cool ones. Whereas NBA Jam is kind of on its own, right? In that field. Madden is, again, you know, another console game. I'm trying to think of any other sports. Rugby had a good game, but again, that was that PC as well? Or was that a console? Might have been console, the old rugby games. I think NBA Jam's kind of on its own. I'm not aware of anyone doing it. I'm more than happy to consult with anyone if they want to have a go. I was actually going to buy a pair of NBA Jam sneakers the other day. I don't think that says anything good about me as a person. Ali says, do you think Namibia, Netherlands, and especially Ireland were disappointing this World Cup given how good US, Nepal, and Scotland have played? Ireland should be far better than Afghanistan, but they just seem to regress. Or is that too harsh? They came to this World Cup having been in Pakistan. That now form doesn't look as good, Ali, as we thought it did. No, look, they've been playing really good cricket. They beaten some good teams at home. They don't play, I think they have a bit of an old-fashioned style. If you compare them to Scotland, I just think you look at Scotland and Scotland is set up to be a really good T20 side. And I'm not sure that Ireland is ready for that yet from that point of view. Namibia, just don't think they have enough batting. Said that people have been very excited about Namibia for a long time, and my issue with them for a long time is they haven't had a lot of batting. Netherlands definitely, Netherlands, had they played better, well, had they beaten South Africa and not panicked a couple of times against Bangladesh, could have been in the Super 8s themselves. So I think the Netherlands will be disappointed. There's so many times in this tournament where I just thought the Netherlands just gave up an advantage and for two or three overs, went from in the game or ahead of the game to massively behind. And I don't know how you fix that. And I don't know if that is a flaw in their team or whether, you know, the pressure got to them or it's just one of those things. So they should be disappointed. Ireland should be disappointed because they were playing good cricket beforehand and have been focusing on T20, and to leave without a win is pretty ordinary, right? Namibia, I think they played about their level. I've got no massive issues with them. Teams like Namibia and Papua New Guinea, very good associate teams, partly because they don't make a lot of mistakes. So if you're going up against, USA is probably a new one, but Scotland is another one. And Nepal is probably another one as well. And Afghanistan, traditionally, those are teams that like come at you very, very hard in associate cricket, but they make a lot of mistakes. So teams like Papua New Guinea and Namibia are very, very good at going, okay, top of off, everyone fields. We run between the wickets really well. We try really hard and let's see how we go. There are games and situations where that works really well, but they don't have a lot of big weapons. So, you know, Namibia have kind of three players, and two now, that have the ability to shape games, and a lot of other guys who are just good, solid, you know, lower level cricketers. And so I do think from that, you know, it would be hard for them to be consistently good, but that doesn't mean they won't have a good tournament every now and again, because again, they put themselves into really good positions. Let's take another break here on Wagwheel, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is brought to you by Cricket Aid. Cricket intelligence for you every day.
All right, Josh says, 11 years ago, Piers Morgan faced Brett Lee in the nets. If Brett Lee was bowling seriously, how many deliveries do you think you would personally survive trying to draw a test match? Just depends on how often he misses the stumps, right? I wouldn't be able to pick it up. I'd have two advantages facing Brett Lee. He's got a very normal bowling action, so I think I would struggle a lot more with Shoaib Akhtar or Mitchell Johnson or Sean Tate or Lasith Malinga. I've faced a lot of guys with pretty much Brett Lee's action, even if they were, you know, half the pace. And the other advantage I would have with Brett Lee is that he swings the ball away, and so there's always a chance I'm not going to nick it, right? So You know, from that perspective, he's just going to keep missing the bat. And until he bowls a straight ball, I've got, you know, I'm in that kind of situation. Oh, actually, I've got a third advantage. I don't pick up tall bowlers particularly well, and he's not that tall. So that would be quite handy to me. I would struggle much more with Morning Walker or Steve Harmison or Joel Garner or Kyle Jameson. Again, just don't pick tall bowlers up particularly well, especially if they're quick. But even in general, I feel like I've never done them as well. So, yeah, how long does it take Brett Lee to hit the stumps is your real question here, Josh. William says, we're constantly told that cricket is the second most popular sport in the world, yet most internationals, most domestic tournaments, and many World Cup games are frequently played in front of minuscule crowds. Why is this, and why is cricket not more worried about this? It's the second most Googled sport in the world. It probably has the second largest actual fan base in the world. But, you know, crowds at cricket games have been dwindling for a long time in certain kinds of formats. It's not like football. It doesn't sort of draw in, you know, crowds in that same kind of way. I mean, I remember William going to the NBA, which is the other sport that is fighting for to be the most watched in the world, second most popular sport in the world. And I went to games with really good players playing, you know, Dirk Nowitzki and Pau Gasol and, you know, all these sorts of players where there was like 15,000 seat arena with 2,000 people in it. When I backpacked in 2003 across America, like there were plenty of times. So whereas NFL, from what I can understand, those grounds are almost packed every single time. So again, you have a sport like the NFL, which doesn't have the international reach of basketball. And then you have a sport like basketball that doesn't quite have the crowds. I think there are different ways of supporting it. So it would, you know, if you're looking at a percentage of people, watching games live at grounds, cricket would be really, really low. But if you're looking at the amount of people who would be interested in the results of those games and following it and maybe watching it online and everything else, cricket goes back up again. I know that, you know, with a lot of the betting stuff, you know, having worked with Cricket 8 and all that sort of stuff, like I'm starting to work out just how big cricket is. And betting is a really good way of understanding it. And when you factor in betting, again, cricket has another huge advantage. So there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of, energy with cricket. But you're right. It doesn't pack grounds. Probably even the way it used to. If you look at cricket before World War II, there's a lot of full grounds, even for first-class fixtures. So I don't know what cricket needs to do specifically to fix that. But you could argue that T20 cricket has actually done quite well. But there's also a lot of T20 cricket where no one turns up. Rudra says, West Indies have, versus weak opposition, done a lot better, especially with the ball, than I expected them to pre-tournament. How do you see them going in the Super 8s? Do they have a legitimate shot in the finals? Well, they've also made some runs now. Akhil Hasan has been bowling really, really well. I like his bowling. I think when he bowls against better sides, he will be limited. But he's still... I really like him as a player, as a fielder, as a batter. He puts it all out. He played as a pinch blocker at one stage in this tournament, right? So I really like him. Gurukesh Modi hasn't actually bowled that well yet. So I think their bowling can get better. But I think Alzari Joseph has probably been overperforming. I think the problem for the West Indies will be when they get on good quality pitches against good quality opposition, of how they handle things like the death overs where they're not really set up. And they're not. And if Akhil Hasan doesn't take early wickets, they're not really set up to take wickets at the top or at the bottom. So that would be my issue with them overall as a side so far. Rudra says, India plays their Super 8 games in Barbados versus Afghanistan, Antigua versus Bangladesh, and St. Lucia versus Australia. How do these conditions favour them versus their opponents? I think Barbados probably, just because it's, you know, it's been a low-scoring, scrappy one, probably helps Afghanistan a little bit. But, you know, it's also been good for spinners, so India have plenty of options to go up against them. Antigua doesn't help Bangladesh at all, right? It's a high-scoring ground. They don't want high-scoring grounds. Their best chance of winning is in low-scoring games. And then St. Lucia is probably going to be a batting-friendly wicket. So I suppose if you are worried about sort of head marsh, stoyness, whacking sixes everywhere, and taking the score away from you, that could favour Australia a little bit there, is what I would have thought head-to-head. So probably the wicket that helps them the most is the Antigua one versus Bangladesh. But they're pretty well-rounded side, so I'm not massively worried about them as a team. You know, do you know what I mean? Like, they are set up for these kinds of conditions. But yeah, there might be certain things that are helping their opposition a little bit there. Will says, would the 100 have worked better if it had been six teams that were split between the counties equally? Northern England, Durham, Lancashire, Yorkshire, East Midland. Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying. No, I don't think so. What's the identity of that? Like, I'm not an expert on English culture, Will, but having watched Game of Thrones.
I didn't catch that.
Even Siri doesn't like that one. Having watched Game of Thrones, I do think that there is a very good explanation that certain different regions, even within geographical areas, may not like each other. And I think, I find it very hard to think that Gloucestershire, Glamorgan, and Somerset are all going to come together as a Western Britain. And I certainly don't think Northern England of Durham, Lancashire and Yorkshire is going to work particularly well either. They were clearly trying to replicate American sports and the Big Bash and the IPL and, you know, those sorts of things. It's harder in the UK just because of the way that city culture is so dominated by one city, which it isn't in somewhere like Australia, right? Or America. So it may not have been a perfect situation, but I can't see how your system is any better. I would say it's worse just looking at it right here. Matt says, in Test cricket, there have always been plenty of bowlers that were handy batters and then improved to become bowling all-rounders. Who are the batters that have been handy bowlers and turned themselves into batting all-rounders? I'm really interested with this one, Matt. Who are the players that you would consider have become bowling all-rounders after being handy with the bat? Because I can't think of any off the top of my head. What you do get is quite often bowlers who hit that 28, 29 mark when they get a little bit better at batting, because that's their peak batting years. And so there's probably a little bump there, but I'm trying to think of players who've suddenly become all-rounders, right? Handy number eights, yes. Number sevens, number sixes, are there players who have done that? Generally, what you're talking about is probably players who are all-rounders already. And again, they're reaching their peak. So Jadeja, Imran Khan, Vittori, those sorts of players, probably, you know, maybe Flintoff is another one as well, sort of reaching their batting peak and then getting a little bit better at batting. But they were already all-rounders. Whereas I feel like you're more talking about, what, Shane Warne type players? Mitchell Starc or Pat Cummins type players. And I don't think they're all-rounders because they don't give you an extra batting option because they're still averaging in the low 20s and they can't bat higher up the order. So I don't know if I agree with that. As far as what people who didn't bowl much at the start of their career who become better, Michael Bevan's a really interesting one, right? Because Michael Bevan doesn't actually play that much Test cricket and realistically probably doesn't even bowl that much. But he was someone who, let's have a look, Michael Bevan, 18 test matches, 29 wickets. I think 10 of those are in one game, right? But he was certainly someone who was not a bowler and then at test level became a bowler. I'm trying to think, I feel like there's a couple in the 1950s that I cannot think of off the top of my head. I mean, the main thing is that bowlers are generally athletically gifted. That's, you know, they have an athletic gift that allows them to bowl fast or to spin the ball a long way, or whatever it may be. And you probably can't polish, you know, you either have that or you don't. So if you have that, it's probably very readily apparent when you're 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, right? Whereas batting, your peak is way later, right? You know, your athletic bowling peak is quite early on and your batting peak is probably a lot later. So I think what you're really seeing there is just differences in peaks. But if you have bowling skill, How many bowlers have we had that are properly late bloomers? Someone like Colin Miller, who picked up a whole new skill. There's obviously the wrist spinners, but they spend years and years mastering the art, right? And there really isn't that many other bowlers who get good later on. So why would we think that batters would be able to do that? I suppose you might get a bowler, a batter who later on in their career can work out how to be useful at times, but that would probably be it. And I think that's actually what you're talking about with bowlers. They're actually just finding out how to be more useful with the bat. They're not really working out how to become all-rounders. I could be wrong, but you might need to give me the examples so I can have a look at them. But I don't think I agree with that theory. Bloody says, in the 1980s, did some West Indian cricketers play more days of cricket in England than the West Indies? Considering that they all played county cricket and there are a lot less test matches played back then, this question was inspired by the fact Gordon Greenidge moved to England as a teenager but managed to play for the West Indies without moving away from England. Yeah, there weren't many red stripe games, Bloody. So almost every West Indian player was playing more in England than they were in the West Indies, because even the ones who weren't playing first-class cricket were playing league cricket. So the majority of them, all those old West Indians have all these random places. So they'll come over, for a test series or for a holiday, whatever, and they'll end up somewhere in Staffordshire or Lancashire somewhere up north in one of the league clubs that they played for, where they still have friends from, a couple of years playing there. And quite often they would live in the UK for, 5, 6, 7 months, whatever it was at that point. Most of them didn't live in the UK full time, partly because they made their money in the UK and that money went back a lot further in the West Indies. Plus, I can only assume much better weather. I don't have to assume that. But I would be thinking that that is a big part of why that happened. A lot of those West Indies cricketers didn't actually play that much cricket in the West Indies. I don't know if I would be able to. Let's pick a player. I want to pick someone who played. So if we did Andy Roberts, I wonder if I can do this live. Might be pushing myself a little bit here. But if we did, is Andy Roberts a good one? Yeah, I'll go Andy Roberts for a minute. Let's see. If we do his first class cricket. Nope. Helps if I actually say his name. Oh no, here he is. All right, there are a million Andy Roberts, of course. So Andy Roberts of the West Indies, AIM, there he is. Okay, so he played 47 test matches. And let's have a look at first class record for each team. He bowled 4,000 balls for Leeward Island, combined Leeward and Windward Islands. He bowled 4,000 balls for Leeward Islands. And that's his first class balls for domestic teams. So that was about 9,000 balls, domestic West Indian first class deliveries. He bowled 10,000 balls for Hampshire. He bowled 6,600 balls for Leicestershire. He bowled another 251 for New South Wales. So even if you add all of his West Indian deliveries up, he probably bowled almost as much in county cricket. And I don't think, I could be wrong with this, but I don't think he was particularly someone who played that many matches in county cricket. That's only a couple of years, right? So if you looked up someone who actually played regularly, and that's, you're just talking about first class cricket. You then go back and you start to factor in league cricket there. And I don't know if Andy Roberts did. But you're talking about a guy who's not really known as a county bowler who still bowled 16,000 balls in county cricket. So imagine what some of these other guys were doing. So yeah, it was very common for that to happen. Ben says, if you were commissioned by one of the big streaming platforms to make a documentary trying to find and prove that match fixing happens, cheating happens in major cricket tournaments, what would you do and how would you start? Oh, that's a really, really interesting one. I would probably identify a couple of leagues. I would partner up with companies like Decimal and Sports Radar to look at patterns algorithmically that don't make sense. And then I would And then I would be looking, you'd be looking at getting a proper investigative journalist on board. You know, I'm a good feature journalist, but I'm not, you know, great in investigations. So I think that would be one person that you would want. And you probably want then another like hard hitting news journalist on the ground in India. Going through, well, certainly someone who spoke Hindi and Urdu anyway, because so much of it is not done in English, right? So I think you need those sorts of skills available to you to put the team together. And I wonder if the algorithms and of certain players, maybe with certain brackets and things, that you might be able to work out which players are look like they're being involved, and you could probably maybe even look at doing a sting, but I'm not sure if that's where you would want to go with that. But you would certainly, that's where I would start with the algorithms. We have some of these things, and quite often these fixes leak into legal markets. But yeah, I don't know. That's probably where I would start, I would think. I think if I did it, it would be a very different kind of movie. I don't think I'd be trying to prove match fixing exists. I would be more looking at the fact that in global sport, we have a group that is independent that looks for drugs in sport, and they're completely hampered by the fact that the biggest problem in sport is corruption in sport, and we don't have a group that independently looks into corruption in sport. And everything that happens in sport now is really through, you know, either dodgy governments, kickbacks, unprofessional workplaces, you know, whatever it is, that all comes back to forms of mismanagement and corruption. And we don't have any organization going, this is terrible. Ben says, you spoke previously about your favorite all-time commentators. Who are your favorite commentators to work with? I love Dan Norcross is probably my favorite commentator to work with. And I started with him, so we kind of learnt the art very much together, many hours on the sofa on our own. So we probably work together better than anyone else just because we know how each other's thinking and which directions we're going to go in. Neil Manthorpe has been absolutely brilliant. I loved working with Jim Maxwell, you know, back a long time ago as well. Who else have I worked with? I'm trying to think. I love working with Harmy, you know, and Goffy is another one that I think me and Goffy find a really good pattern sort of to work off each other. And I think that's kind of what it is. So there are other really good commentators, but we don't always work as well together, even if they're absolutely brilliant, just because that's not how it works. Harsha is someone, again, I just feel me and Harsha work really well together. I'm trying to think of, there's a bunch of other names. And then, you know, Jade Dernbach and Gareth Batty are two that I just think are wonderful at explaining cricket to people. So, you know, to be able to poke them and prod them. But yeah, you know, I'm trying to think, because there's kind of, that's all the modern talk sporty type people. And then Norcross. And I'm trying to think of like way back in the old days who I used to work with as well. There's someone else that I worked with a couple of times. Oh, I love working with, I did a stint with Ian Bell once. I can't even remember who I was working with, but me and Belly did a stint together. And like, I thought Belly was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And he doesn't do much of it. And I noticed he commentated with someone else. He didn't have the same rapport. He knew me a little bit because we worked together when I was at Craig Info. But yeah, we got along really, really well. And I would have loved to have done more stuff with him. Anna says, who was burnt out? Waka was him? Was him? So Waka was incredible for a short period of time, essentially when he was bowling, probably very close to, you know, Jeff Thompson speed, with that sort of wind up waist and reverse swing into the stumps. There wasn't a lot you could do, but Waka, it was really useful as sort of a one dimensional bowler. Whereas if you look at Wasim Akram, he's brilliant with the old ball, he's brilliant with the new ball. He can swing the ball both ways. He can bowl Yorkers, but he can bowl length. He can bowl short. he was a completely different package, and he was left arm. And I think he was better. I think Wacker probably had a better peak, and Wasim probably had a way better career altogether. But yeah, I would certainly go with Wasim, I think, every day of the week there. We're going to be doing the scoreboard soon, but I can see I'll take a quick break here for a couple of questions on in the group, and then we'll come back. And certainly, if there's any super chats in there, I'll pick those up as well. I'm Jared Kimber, and this is Wagon Wheel.
This is brought to you by Cricket 8, the new home of cricket intelligence.
All right, welcome back. Let's see what else we have here. Last couple. All right. So Nathan comes in with, I haven't had many super chats from South Africa before. Thank you, Nathan. He says, long time lurker, first time participator. I like it. I love when people are like, who is the person that first invented that? Was that just like, it sounds like a talkback thing from America. And then we've all learned it from American media. And I wonder if like that's where it started. Anyway, has no idea. That has nothing to do with anything. Regarding the format for this T20 as well as other T20 leagues, have you taken a look at how esports tournaments are structured? I have not, Nathan. I don't know much about esports at all. My son's very much into video games, my oldest boy, and he's one of those kids that's kind of into his own random games. I think it's a battle, I should know what it's called, but the Star Wars one where you can shoot people, Battle something. Is his big one at the moment. And obviously, you know, he was into Minecraft and Zelda and some of the other games. So I'm assuming in the next 5 to 10 years, I'm going to learn more about esports. But at the moment, it's not something that I'm all that much into. I don't think anyone thinks that, you know, the cricket tournaments are set up perfectly, though. So I'm sure you are right. And there are some other sports out there. And we have seen, of course, you know, the IPL has a slightly better structure than some of the other tournaments because it is copied from, you know, Aussie rules and rugby league. So we can learn things from other sports about how to bring these things together, and hopefully we will again. But thank you for your super chat, sir. Aman says, why are there so many all-rounders in cricket? Is it just athleticism with both bowling and batting require, or any other biological factor or skill? I don't think there are that many all-rounders in cricket. How many players are there in the world at the moment that you would pick as your top four bowler and your top six batter? I'm pausing because I can't think of anyone outside of Jadeja. And Jadeja's, he's not a great number six, but he's certainly not a bad number six. So I would have no issue with him as number six. He's probably a number seven at his best, right? But he could certainly bat at number six. Jason Holder had a period where he did it, I think. I think Ben Stokes, I don't know. I just don't think Ben Stokes was ever quite consistent enough with the ball to be a top four bowler, but Ben Stokes wasn't far away. So that's three, and Shakib would have been the one before that, right? And that's not a lot, is it? I think the term all-rounder is used a little bit loosely. I think the one reason, and I've done a podcast for this with a baseball writer about why baseball didn't have all-rounders and why cricket does. And one of the main reasons is you look at American sports and they just make people specialize, you know, one particular position and you do this and that is what you do. And then maybe one day if you fail, you can try something else. Or you get old, we might have to move you to another position, right? Whereas you look at the English sports, you know, and cricket and rugby and I suppose you would put football in that as well. Players aren't one particular position, right? They might be an attacking player in football, but they might actually, you know, play as a striker, or they might play a little bit further back, or whatever that position might be. You know, we have defenders in football who sometimes play, you know, as midfielders, and there is a switch, and then you have something like total football that comes along. So I just think, and even in rugby, I know there's a lot of positional, but you still have to do some of the other roles. And cricket is a sport where you have to bat, right? So baseball pitchers didn't only bat every, what, 3 or 4 days in the old, before all the designated hitter stuff came in, only because they wouldn't pitch every game. So it's not quite the same. And they were forgiven for not being able to bat. Whereas I think in cricket, it's a little bit different, and we expect a little bit more from that point of thing. So I do think it's slightly different in the way that sport is set up. But yeah, I don't think there are actually that many all-rounders. I don't think there are that many all-rounders in the history of cricket. There is only one player who has 500 runs and 50 wickets who has averaged over 40 with the bat and under 30 with the ball, right? I think that tells you that there aren't actually that many genuine all-rounders. Aubrey Faulkner. AB says, speed gun was first used in 1999 as per ChatGPT. Oh, I think it was used a little bit before that, but it was certainly, versions of speed guns were used in the late 70s, right? And you can go back actually before that. There were other ways that were trying to track the trajectory of balls, but the late 70s speed bowling competition was the first one that we really started to get into that. Hypercore says, which all-rounders throughout cricket history have come closest any point in their careers to being both the best batter and best bowler in the world at the same time? The Elise Perry, Hypercore. It's Aubrey Faulkner, I think, was ranked in the top five, maybe in the top two. I think he was ranked number two in both, wasn't he? And maybe got to number one in one. But it wasn't quite at the same time. It was in the same sort of period of time. But he was a brilliant bowler in England, if I remember correctly, and didn't make a lot of runs there. And was a brilliant batter in Australia and maybe didn't take as many wickets there. I'm trying to think back, but that's my memory of Aubrey Faulkner. And so he was kind of, you know, there were times when he sort of shot up one rankings and sort of went down the other one. But yeah, I would have thought Aubrey Faulkner, again, I can't believe he's come up twice in 2 minutes. Even for me, that seems a bit freaky. But yeah, he's the one that I would have thought of. And then I don't know where Ian Botham was in terms of unofficial rankings, if we had rankings at that stage. But I would have assumed he would have been quite high up from, what, 77 to 1981 or whatever it was in that kind of period. The first 20 tests of his career, he would have been quite high up. But I don't think he ever would have been top five batters, but probably would have been for bowlers, I would have thought. Yes, I think that makes sense. Crick Freak says, do you think Gary Stead tenure has run its course and New Zealand need a bit of freshness now? Oh, I just think they need to change a lot of things. I think they're coming to the end and I don't think like Gary Stead has done a bad job, but they need the next coach who's planning on the next 5 years. And if that's not him, you know, he ran his team. If they think he's the best person to regenerate this side, then they should keep him around and all of his plans should be about regenerating the side. But if they don't, then they need to move on. The same as from Kane and Tim, as you say there. There's a whole generational shift happening in that team. A new coach to come in over the next 3 or 4 years. I don't think whoever coaches New Zealand in the next 3 or 4 years is going to have masses of success, though. I just don't think they have the bowling attack anymore. Crick Freak says, always wanted to know your thought on Curtis Patterson. Opened in a test for Australia in 2019, got 100 and then never played again, especially when Australia were looking for someone after Warner. Yeah, I mean, I remember when he was really, really young. Did he make his debut in first-class cricket at like a ridiculously young age? So what is he? He's only 31 now. I reckon he makes his debut, let's see what year. He made his first-class debut in 2011 and he was born in 93. So yeah, he was like 17, 18. I thought he was even younger than that. I remember hearing about him when he was very young then. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Look, he's played almost 100 first class games and he averages under 40. That's the reason he's not back in the side. You know, he's a good, solid player. I don't know if there's anything, I don't know if there's anything truly exceptional about him outside of his, patience and his general technique. Like he's not a bad player, but I don't know what about him suggests international level. Player, just very solid first-class player, not going to be easy to dismiss or anything. I don't know how he puts pressure back on players. I know he made that 100, but you've got to look at someone's entire record, when you're looking at something like that. So I just want to have a look at his last few years, because that's one thing I haven't looked him up in a while. So first few years, second and third season, he averaged 20s. Then he had a couple of really good years. And then 2020, 21, he averaged 21. Then he averaged 28. Then he averaged 29. Then he averaged 14. So I think he was probably a child prodigy. He was very hard to dismiss, would be my guess. And he just didn't develop in the way. And he's only 31. He should be at his peak now, and he's not. Michael Klinger was very similar to this. Klinger was an incredible young player who Victoria played at a very early age and then played him for 8 years. He never made any runs for Victoria. Then just as he was getting to his peak at 20, he couldn't even hit the ball off the square sometimes. And then just as he was getting to his peak at 27, 28, he completely blossomed into another player and finally became the level of player that everyone thought. And by that stage, his sort of international career had moved on a little bit. You know, he was never going to be playing much international cricket for Australia at that point, Klinger. Patterson hasn't even had that renaissance yet. But the one thing that was interesting about Bevan, of course, is that he moved states and left Victoria and went to South Australia, where he wasn't the prodigal son anymore. He could just play. So I do wonder if Patterson maybe could have benefited from that. But he should be making more runs at the moment. I haven't even had him on my radar for a long time. So I think that tells you kind of where he is from my perspective. Anyway, that's the end of the show again today. So thank you to everyone for being in the chat and the super chats and the normal chats, and certainly everyone on Patreon. I'm going to be back in a couple of minutes anyway for the scoreboard. So I don't even know why you would leave. You should just stay here. You should just like get one of those Elon Musk brain chips. But if you're just listening on the podcast, well, you can't listen to the scoreboard. So you're going to have to come to YouTube if you want to watch that one. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.